Is your appetite sometimes out of control? Are you unable to stop eating even when you're full? Download our new Intelligent Medicine video, Defensive Eating, Taming Your Addiction to Food. There's a physiological basis for food addiction. The food industry has gripped our brains using powerful food science. Find out what we can do about it. Go to drhoffman.com to download this important video. We will arm you with proven strategies to change your eating behavior forever. Go to drhoffman.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about something that I think is very, very important in the field of integrative medicine, which is the subject of testing. How do we find out what we need to know? Where does integrative medicine, functional medicine, perhaps go a little further than the usual, you know, CBC, regular lipid profile, some of the conventional blood panels that you'd ordinarily receive at your doctor? This is important because we in integrative medicine look at issues that sometimes don't so much concern conventional doctors. We look at food allergies. We look at levels of vitamins, minerals, and essential fatty acids, amino acids, and so on. We also look at the issue of toxicity, which is a very important issue when it comes to getting people well. So with us, I think, is probably the number one authority on testing, and I really mean it. This is a colleague of mine who I've known for my entire professional career, and I've really looked up to him as a role model and as a real guru on the subject of testing. He's Dr. Russell Jaffe. He received his BSMD and PhD from Boston University School of Medicine, and he's board certified in clinical pathology and in chemical pathology. Now, if you think a pathologist is just a guy who cuts up dead bodies and does autopsies, well, think again, because pathologists in medicine are the folks who run laboratories and devise tests and supervise the accuracy and precision of the tests that doctors rely upon. And Dr. Jaffe, although conventionally trained, has turned his attention to a more integrative model, a functional medicine model. And he's been a real innovator in this field, coming up with all manner of very, very beneficial tests that help us ascertain the status of patients. He's also known to possibly some of you as the developer of an important food intolerance test. It's called the ELISA ACT test, A-C-T. He's also developed the PERQ supplement line, P-E-R-Q-U-E, which is an outstanding supplement line. In fact, it was so outstanding that it was selected as the supplement line that was used in a recent trial of chelation therapy. So without further ado, you know, and I could go on, but then I'd waste our entire podcast with your accolades, Dr. Jaffe. It's a pleasure having you here on Intelligent Medicine.
Dr. Hoffman, a real pleasure to be with you. And indeed, we have been colleagues and learned from each other for many years.
So how did you get into this field? Because it's kind of an interesting story. You started out with sort of a conventional orientation with very classical training. So what got you to turn your attention to the problems of functional medicine?
Well, I came as a skeptic. You're quite right. I didn't learn about much of what I advocate for today either at Boston University Medical Center or in my service at the National Institutes of Health. And I felt an obligation to put patients' welfare first, as we always seek to do. And I was giving talks about snake oil, and I included most of what I would now call functional integrative evidence-based medicine in my ignorance at that time. I couldn't imagine that after all the training I had had, that there could be whole knowledge areas that were highly important to best outcomes in terms of patient care, yet of which I was ignorant. So I went to debunk Chinese medicine and did a seven-year apprenticeship with Qing Wu. I went to debunk Ayurvedic medicine and ended up with a decade and a half with Ramamurti Mishra, the man who wrote textbook of yoga psychology and a variety of other what we would today call cross-territorial or integrative approaches. And then I went to debunk mindfulness and ended up with Bhante Dharmawara. And I would suggest that if one practices for about 10,000 hours, that as Richie Davidson has shown with functional MRI scans of the brain, that your brain changes in response to what you eat and drink, think and do. And that's not an opinion. I believe that is a fact. But it was a fact of which I was ignorant before I went to prove that I was right, discovered my lack of understanding, and they became my teachers. And then I had the great good fortune of becoming their clinician. So I had the opportunity to sit at their feet as the student, and then I had that more intimate relationship as you would between a doctor and their patient.
And you, it seems like you never looked back once you got a taste of this more comprehensive approach to optimizing patients' health.
Never looked back, and I do believe it's, in a sense, a back-to-the-future approach. I am confident that tomorrow's safer, more scientific medicine will be what you and I hold today as functional or integrative or comprehensive care. And I find lots of support from the giants on whose shoulders we stand. However, we had about a generation of about three or four decades of ignoring one side of the scientific fence and focusing all of our attention on the other. That is, we stopped paying attention to lifestyle and physiology, and we did pay a lot of attention to pathology and pathophysiology and pharmacopathology to the exclusion of almost all else.
So how would give us the basic outlines of how an integrative testing and evaluation approach might differ from a conventional evaluation of, say, a patient who comes complaining of fatigue and malaise?
That's right. Someone who is unwell in a broad kind of sense, I suggest today exclusively to start functional, predictive biomarker tests, and I interpret them based on what we call goal values. And what that means is I no longer really am interested in what I call physical chemistry, that is, the usual multiphasic tests that are done are so blunt, so imprecise, so unhelpful, that frankly, I don't order them. If they're there, I look at them because I'm a laboratorian as well as a clinician. But what I want to know is your neurohormone balance. I want to know your immune tolerance or what you're intolerant to in relation to delayed allergies and food sensitivities. I want to know whether your microbiome is talking well and interacting well with your metabolome. Now, I know we used to say digestion and metabolism, and we're really talking about the same thing, but in a larger, fuller context, it really is a microbiome. And I do want to know what's going on there, and you have metabolism or the metabolome, and I do want to know what's going on there. But it turns out physical chemistry, the tests from the 19th and early 20th century that are still commonly in use, don't give us that information.
Indeed, they fall short.
Way short. They're confusing. It often ends up with the doctor looking at the tests and saying to the person who is not feeling well that they're probably okay because there's nothing abnormal in the tests.
Exactly.
And I said they did the wrong tests or interpreted what they had in a less functional way, and that today the weight of evidence, the scientific method, is completely in support of what we're talking about, even though we're still speeding the transition from sick care, which is what I was taught to do, healthful caring, which is what we share in common and what I believe will be tomorrow's medicine.
So one way of looking at it is that instead of focusing on abnormalities that might suggest a catastrophic illness, like do you have cancer, do you have ulcerative colitis, do you have, are you having a heart attack, we're looking at biomarkers where none of the conventional tests might be positive, but we're looking at areas for potential optimization, where there's a departure from optimal, not just a catastrophic organ failure, correct?
No, that's exactly right. I want to know those tests that predict 10-year all-cause survival, all-cause morbidity, mortality. And it turns out, if you select correctly, that you cover all of lifestyle, all of epigenetics, all of what we would call non-genetic, that is, the lifestyle, and in essence, the things that are the result of what you eat, drink, think, and do. And the good news is that you can favorably change habits of daily living and document years to decades of likely good health because the predictive biomarker interpreted to goal value confirms that your risk has gone down, but most importantly, your resilience, your health vitality has gone up.
Well, you know, I think, and from my experience, patients really like to get report cards. And even if they're, you know, maybe getting a C+, they want to go for an A or an A+. And, you know, when there's an abnormality that you can point to, it's really a teachable moment. It gives you an opportunity to intercede positively and motivate a patient to make significant lifestyle changes, whether it be diet, whether it be exercise, whether it be taking nutraceuticals or undergoing a detoxification program. This is the essence of functional medicine.
When I was asked to participate in a group comparing Germany with America in regard to health promotion, in regard to disease prevention, in regard to disease treatment, in regard to innovation, we put together a checklist. We put together a report card. And initially, because people were unfamiliar with it, there was a little resistance, but it's now become fairly standard. And checklists, Peter Pronovost, I believe, is a candidate for the Nobel Prize because he got people in hospitals to actually follow step by step the checklist, because people can be more forgetful, and if they are reminded, they're more mindful. So there's lots of examples where we've taken a mechanistic view, in essence, the view of the pathologist, where it matters what the diagnosis is. And yet there are people like me who can confirm that more people die of their diagnosis and the anxiety associated with that than with actually their pathology. Mm-hmm. And if I say that a little differently, I think one of the more helpful things I do often is explain to people that they are unique and that their condition doesn't really fit any particular diagnosis exactly. And therefore, we're going to just look at how well they feel and function. We're going to go by those tests that predict the true predictive biomarkers. We're going to go by the tests that really are integrative and functional. And we're going to make that the norm. And I agree with you that when you give people attainable goals, and then you reward them psychologically, emotionally, and maybe even financially, workplace wellness and other similar programs, for example. You save lives and you save an awful lot of money and you reduce risk and you reduce anxiety.
Well, in fact, I think it was well said by one of our good colleagues, Dr. Jeffrey Bland. He wrote a book called The Disease Delusion. In other words, we try to fit people into disease categories, disease boxes. Now there's a new ICD-10, which has 70,000 of them. And yet there's no category for essential fatty acid deficiency. There's no category for suboptimal methylation. These
right,
are concepts
if,
that we
just,
really...
If we just look at that for a moment, in the regulatory world, our Food and Drug Administration, they do differentiate saturated, monounsaturated, and polyunsaturated fats, but all polyunsaturated fats, according to the consensus of the FDA, are the same. So omega-3, omega-6, it's okay. 10% of calories from omega-6 has been recommended by medical societies. And if I wanted to think of ways to induce more inflammation and to reduce repair, I would have a disproportionate omega-6 intake and less of the beneficial EPA, DHA, active omega-3 repair-promoting fats. My recommendation to people is about 4-to-1, whereas according to the NHANES National Nutrition Survey, many Americans have 50 to 100 times the omega-6 intake that they have compared to omega-3. And that imbalance feeds, if not maybe even precipitates, ill health.
Well, you have actually stated that a lot of this is covered by 8 predictive biomarkers. So can we touch upon those? What might be central to an integrative evaluation?
Exactly. So if we look at the category of all tests, there are over 100,000. If we look at the tests that are recent in innovation and could broadly be considered functional, we have probably 5,000. But if you want to cover the 92% of lifetime health and vitality that is, quote, epigenetic or is lifestyle-based, there are only 8 tests you need. And I'd be delighted to go through them quickly, the categories, sure. The 8 of them, and then maybe we could take each one in itself.
Great.
So
well,
it's hemoglobin. Right. So we start. So of the 8, the first one is hemoglobin A1C. Now, hemoglobin A1C means extra sugar stuck onto the hemoglobin protein, and it means an imbalance in average sugar inside the cell. So I have given up on measuring blood sugar because white coat hyperglycemia exists just as white coat hypertension exists. But I want to know the hemoglobin A1C, and I want it in a high sensitivity version. That is, I want the lab to be able to report a result plus or minus 5%, not plus or minus 15 or 20%. It used to be that the best we could do was compare individuals to statistical ranges and hope that we could interpret the results. Now I don't care about the statistical ranges because people are individuals. And if I have a test that's predictive, like hemoglobin A1C, and I have that result, plus or minus 5%, I can actually guide therapy based on that test in regard to sugar, insulin, energy, economy.
And as,
the second test,
excuse me,
yeah.
as you know, one of the problems with the tests that we use conventionally is that the criteria are either excessively stringent, you know, like everybody's got to get their LDL cholesterol under 70, or alternatively excessively lenient, so that they say, well, you know, you're not quite diabetic, your hemoglobin A1C is 6.1. You know, we'll let you know when it gets to 6.4, and then you have diabetes, and then we can start the meds, right?
Well, you see, there we look back to the work of Chereskin and Ringsdorf and other colleagues who showed that the healthy value, the goal value for hemoglobin A1C, say, is less than 5%. And so I don't look at the statistical range because I don't want to make people into statistics. I want to look for that individual at whether their hemoglobin A1C is less than 5%, and I want that value to be plus or minus 5%. The second test is a measure of repair and inflammation, and it's the high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, or hsCRP. This is a test that Paul Ridker and Rafai and others have made a whole career about. It's not specific for cardiac problems, that was thought at one time, but it's a very good measure of all-cause morbidity and mortality in regard to repair deficit, cumulative repair deficit, which is really what inflammation is. So I no longer see inflammation the way pathologists do as a fire to be fought and suppressed. I do see inflammation as a repair deficit and an opportunity to remove obstacles to recovery and evoke healing responses.
Okay.
And in regard to the hsCRP, the goal value, the best outcome, morbidity, mortality, 10-year outcome, survival, and the best value for today and tomorrow is less than 0.5.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I got to tell you how very few of my patients initially achieve that goal. Often after, you know, intensive lifestyle modification, they do get to that goal, and it's laudable.
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. And I'll tell you the personal experience. When I did these tests on myself, my hemoglobin A1C was quite okay, thank you very much, but my hsCRP took quite a while to get down to the goal value of 0.5. And I needed to be more physically active. I've always been pretty mentally active, but they go together. I've always been pretty good about diet, but now I'm better. And more importantly, I'm taking handfuls of safer supplements 4 to 5 times a day. Why? Because I want my blood pressure and other values to be at their goal value. And when I'm a good fellow, that is, I follow all of my own advice, you know, I don't just preach it, I practice it. I can tell you my blood pressure is 100 over 60. I can tell you my resting pulse is below 60. I can tell you that I'm getting restorative sleep better than I ever did before. That's another story. And with great difficulty, my HSCRP has finally come down to the goal value.
It's also kind of handy that you own a high-quality vitamin company and you've got free access to unlimited supplements.
It definitely helps. If I had to purchase these, I would be spending hundreds of dollars a month. But I believe that investing in both my kitchen and investing in quality supplements is such that I won't have to invest in the emergency room down the road. Right. And I have been, for a variety of reasons, extraordinarily well scanned and tested over the last year. I've had a total body PET and a brain PET. I've had a functional MRI. I've had an MRI of my gut and chest, and a whole series of other tests and functional tests. And according to the synthesis of all of it, I continue to function as a 35 to 40-year-old. Now, the fellow I mentioned, Bhante Dharmawala.
And we know you're older than that because I've known you for 30 years. So, see, spoiler alert there.
I can tell you that I receive Medicare and I am Social Security. I am a Medicare beneficiary, but I don't ever expect to actually
there
use
you go.
That.
Enough said.
But I will say that my dad, who we had till he was 90, despite lots of health challenges in his childhood from poverty, that my dad took every supplement we make. Of course, I sent them to him, but he took every one we make because I thought at some point someone would say, has anyone ever taken everything you make and survived? I would tell him, my father. So, yes, this is an investment. Yes, I am aware that when you do as I do now, which is 4 to 5 doses a day, not just morning and evening, I try to keep to people's on rising and breakfast, dinner and before bed. Compliance is much better that way. But I am motivated because while my blood pressure is not terrible if I take supplements twice a day, I really want my blood pressure to be same as my son Sky, who's 27, and his blood pressure is 100 over 60. And when I follow through fully on what I'm describing today, so is mine.
So let's move on to number three.
Mm-hmm. Number three is homocysteine. This goes back to the 60s when McCulley, who was a pathologist, showed that aggressive atherosclerosis is often related to imbalances in sulfur amino acids. Methionine and homocysteine come to mind. And so we measure homocysteine, but it's a hard thing to measure accurately. And not only do I want it accurately, which means I don't want the homocysteine to have leaked out of the red cell before we measure the amount, I want the value plus or minus 5%. And the goal value is less than 6 micromoles per liter. And again, it's challenging to get to those goal values. However, having been rewarded for the effort, I won't go back.
Okay.
Now, number four gets to the immune tolerance and intolerance question. And here the category is LRA, or lymphocyte response assay. And thank you for the acknowledgement that I developed the first high-precision lymphocyte response assay, the LRA by Eliza Act. We can now take 1 ounce of blood, and in just a few days, with a variance of less than 3%, so we're very precise and very reproducible, we can say what we find people tolerant to. That's the supermajority of what they eat and get exposed to. And then the few things, typically a half a dozen to a dozen, that according to their white cells responding in the laboratory just as they do in the body, it's an ex vivo assay, according to that assay, these are the substances that people react to.
And just explain how that differs from a regular allergy test, because as a pathologist, you have honed a different direction than conventional allergy blood tests in doing the ELISA ACT test.
Oh, that's exactly right, Ron. Most people even today, when they think of delayed allergy testing or food sensitivity testing, they think of antibodies. Now, antibodies are important, but they can be helpful or harmful. And just measuring the presence of an antibody, like an IgG antibody, doesn't tell you if it's helpful or harmful.
It just tells you that the body is recognizing it. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bad thing for the body.
it actually might be a helpful thing. If you had a childhood illness, you would expect to have memory antibodies, IgG antibodies, against each of the childhood illnesses you had, and these would protect you. These would neutralize if you got exposed in the future. So there's been a big misunderstanding that antibodies are always harmful when mostly they're helpful. And then because without a cell culture test, you can't get at the T cells because they're not mediated by antibody. So we wanted to measure all of the delayed pathways, the harmful antibodies, but ignore the helpful antibodies and the immune complexes and the T cell responses. And in order to do that, we had to develop a novel approach, a novel lymphocyte response assay, the long-lived white cells that carry the memory of your immune system, come in B cell or T cell types or subtypes and classes, and we want to talk to them, but in your own plasma with your own antigen presenting or processing cells, just as it happens in the body. So we set out near 30 years ago to show that not only could we do an ex vivo lymphocyte response assay with high precision, but that we could put that into practice by studying diabetes, both type 1 and type 2, fibromyalgia, adrenal dysfunction, and any of the inflammatory or autoimmune conditions. So today we have over 75,000 cases, over 22 million cell cultures, and we're ready to talk with anyone about this being the standard to compare everything else to, that it does get you what you need, the harmful as antibodies as well as the T cells, without the confusion that IgG testing has.
I hate to break your train of thought here, but we divide these podcasts into two parts, so we managed to work through four of the eight essential predictive biomarkers in part two.
Good time for a pause.
Good time for a pause.
Let me just add one more point.
Sure, please.
Of the eight tests, the four we've just talked about are ready for prime time and absolutely predict 10-year survival as well as how well you'll feel next week. The other four fill in important pieces, and it is my hypothesis or scientific idea that they will take their place once we come back from the break as legitimate and fully evidence-based. I would put them as potential predictive biomarkers to be discussed when we come back.
Indeed. All right. That's a good point at which to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts. When we return, more with Dr. Russell Jaffe on the subject of testing, not just conventional mainstream testing, but functional testing that we do in integrative medicine. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.